Here we do go. Oh my goodness. Tell you what, I'll start even though the rundown says something different. Hey everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the Make Me Smart Daily Edition, and surprise, 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 Molly Wood is not on the other end of this microphone. My goodness. My goodness.
Sorry. Small replacement. Kimberly Adams
it's
here.
It's awesome. Last minute, jumping in for Molly, who, no joke, texted about 10 minutes ago and said, yeah, parts of my neighborhood are on fire and I have to be careful. So we called Kimberly Adams in Washington and said, hey, what you doing in about 10 minutes? And presto, here she is.
Do we know what the fire, the nature of the fire is exactly?
I think it was a restaurant and then also an apartment building. I don't know. It's not great. And fingers crossed for Molly. I mean, by the time this drops, we'll know how it's going. Yeah, we'll know how it's going for her and everybody else too. Anyway, it's the Monday show, Make Me Smart. We're going to talk a little bit differently today about some things. We will, however, start with the business and economic news of the day. Yes, Ms. Adams?
Yes. Something that just came out. We apparently officially entered a recession in February, which, you know, we've been talking about this forever. We knew this was coming, but it's official now.
So what happened was, the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which I love so much, they're the ones who get to decide. They came out today and said the recession, the peak economic activity in this cycle was in February, which means that that's when the recession started. The thing that's really amazing to me about this, and I don't know how you feel, is that here we are in May, and it only took them 3 months to figure this out. And it sounds like I'm being sarcastic, but usually it takes
them
6 or 8 months to figure it out. Yeah, it's super fast. That's the thing. It's super fast because all they had to do was kind of look around, you know? And then the question, of course, becomes, and look, the whole, you know, old definition of two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth thing is out the window, right? That's not the definition that the NBER uses. The question is, what are they going to be looking at for the turnaround? You know?
Really stunned me when I was looking at our friend Kate Davidson's piece in the Journal about this, it's the end of 128-month expansion.
It's crazy.
And then it just fell off a cliff. I mean, so, yes, they say they call it a recession and have a very fancy way to calculate it. And we're over here like, yeah, it just all fell apart, except for the stock market, apparently.
Oh, which I just don't get. And which I think, honestly, it's a little dangerous, honestly, because I think what's happening is people are getting lulled into a false sense of security. Right. Forget the whole everything's opening up and everybody's forgotten about a virus. But they look at the headlines and they feel the wealth effect and they say, oh, look, everything's fine. I mean, the S&P today is back above where it was at the beginning of the year. And that's just not a good thing if you're trying to have people being super cautious out there, I think.
But I mean, in some ways, it's really telling because, you know, who owns stocks in America and who has retirement plans and who are the people who are actively engaged in the day-to-day of the stock market? It's probably not the restaurant workers who lost their jobs. It's probably not the delivery people running around scared that they're going to catch COVID-19. You're sitting in your house. You're mostly protected. You're ordering your delivery and you're probably feeling pretty good. So why not trade some stocks while you're sitting at home on lockdown?
No, for sure. Totally, totally, for sure. And that's one of the great defects of this economy, as it were. Okay, so that's the news. And now we're going to get a little contemplative. Well, yeah, it is kind of personal. And I'm going to back into it this way. We, and you weren't even here, but Molly and I got personal with you and your Uncle David's about a week or two ago.
I heard they were thrilled.
Absolutely delightful. It was so delightful. And it was just this uplifting moment about your uncles and building this fantasy door in the woods. Doorway to the imagination out of what looked like driftwood, although I didn't see any lumber there nearby. But anyway.
No, it was just sticks from the woods.
Oh, was it? Okay. Let us get now a little personal in a different way. You had a Twitter thread Friday? Thursday?
Yeah, Friday, although I started working on it Thursday.
Yeah, well, so tell people what you were tweeting about and tell people about the thought process, would you, that you were working through?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of discussion in the last week or maybe two about, you know, how newsrooms in America have been covering these protests and what it's like to be a black journalist in a predominantly white newsroom talking about issues of police brutality, racial violence, American history, and the protests, to the point that in some newsrooms in Pennsylvania, black reporters are getting pulled off of stories, and black journalists, you know, are kind of slowly starting to talk about some of the ways that we experience racism in the newsroom throughout our careers and what it does to us. And some very prominent journalists have talked about the places they've left because of the racism in their newsrooms. And so I was looking at especially some of the younger journalists I saw tweeting and tweeting kind of like edgy things. And, you know, I'm starting to worry about their jobs and thinking about my experience. I've been in this business for 20 years now, and I decided it was time to say something about it because this whole process reminded me of a conversation that I actually started having with Dave Shaw, who used to be an editor at Marketplace some time ago. And it was during the Me Too movement, and we were out at coffee, and, you know, we were talking about how there were sort of two groups of guys. There were in media. There were the guys who were worried and kind of frantically wandering around, like trying to figure out who they may have messed with in the past and did they need to be worried about being outed. And then there were the people who were just fine. And they were just like, oh, this doesn't worry me at all because I've never harassed anyone. And I said to Dave, what if we did this for racism? What if we decided that just like people who harassed people or who made inappropriate comments in the workplace and all those other things, what if those people that we decided, just like we decided those people were unfit to be leaders in newsrooms, what if we did the same thing for racism? What if we said that all the people who didn't hire black people or didn't promote them or constantly trying to touch their hair in the newsroom or did any of these other microaggressions or didn't pay black people as much, what if we went back and found all of them and held them to the same standard? And sorry, Dave, for recalling our private conversation.
No,
he said, I don't know if there would be anyone left, Kimberly. But this moment made me feel like it was important to highlight the double standard that as many people got angry and said we should go after with, you know, vengeance, all of these guys and a couple of women in Me Too, that there wasn't that same energy and anger about people's whose careers have been destroyed, whose emotional lives have been destroyed from losing their jobs or opportunities or just having a miserable workplace experience because of racism. So I thought very carefully about it, and I wrote 20 tweets, all threaded together, about that and about how black journalists talk to each other about it, and that we know the newsroom leaders who have terrible reputations for this. And I don't know that I want, like, the sort of my uncle asked me, I went to go see my uncle this weekend. He said, well, what are you trying to accomplish? And he said, do you want everybody to get fired? Do you want, you know, people to be put on blast? And I said, I want the conversation to be framed in terms of how damaging this is. I want people to think about that this, unless, you know, I'm not talking about the Me Too rapes and assaults, but I'm talking about the damage to people's careers and lives is very similar. Yeah. That was pretty random.
So it's,
go ahead.
No, it actually was incredibly coherent because, number one, you're a thoughtful woman who put thought into this. But number two, it's so germane. What kind of response have you gotten? Because it's out there, right? And it's buzzing around. First of all, remind people your Twitter handle so they can go read it themselves.
It's well, my work handle is KA underscore marketplace, but the handle under which this is posted is KA reports. The response has been universally that I've seen has been universally positive, actually, because I'm getting two kinds of responses. I'm either getting other black journalists who are basically saying, thanks for saying the quiet thing out loud and agreeing with my tweets and writing me publicly and privately saying that they appreciate me sharing this information and putting it out there. And then I'm hearing other people saying this has been useful. we're listening. This is going to help us be better, you know, in our newsrooms. What's also happening is, and not, this is not just because of me, but because of lots of Black journalists kind of speaking up and writing about this at the moment, is some people are starting to call out particular newsrooms and particular leaders who they feel fit into this paradigm. Now, I do have to sort of check myself here, because leave it to a journalist to take this big national moment and make it about media. But I do think we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And if we're going to talk about, just like, you know, when people started going after guys from Me Too, they were like, well, look at your own industry. And I think if we're going to talk meaningfully about what racism does in America, we have to talk about what racism does in our newsrooms.
No, I think that's exactly right, because without it, honestly, without that, and I'm not going to use the word, without an understanding of what the reality is for Black members of our profession, we're kidding ourselves, and that's brutal.
It's hard work. It's really, like, I think everybody recognizes it's hard work, but that's just it. It's work. You know, people say diversity is hard. Well, how hard is it to launch a new show or start a new podcast or start a new vertical? And somehow we get the resources together, we get the staffing together, everybody trains up and learns what they need to do, and we figure it out and we do a new thing. And yet somehow we haven't been able to do this, and it really does feel like there's not necessarily the energy for it. And now I feel like we're going over time.
Well, we are just a tad, but you and I are the host, so we get to do what we want. And I'm going to take another 90 seconds, and I'm going to ask you, and if you want to duck it, go ahead. But does the conversation feel different this time?
It does feel different this time. But I also think that Black journalists and Black people are behaving differently this time. I'm hearing a lot more. Especially, and I'm going to limit it to Black journalists, because this is who we've got our own circle. We're talking to each other.
Apples to apples here, right.
There's a lot more of us saying, you know what? I'm not going to serve on that diversity committee. I'm not going to serve on that panel. I'm not going to provide this free emotional labor for my white colleagues to figure this out. At this point, if you don't get it, you need to do the work yourself. And unlike in the past, I'm seeing a lot more people actually doing that. Saying, I recognize that I shouldn't be coming to you to help me parse my feelings about, you know, systemic racism. I'm going to go do that myself and then find a way to support you. And that's new. That's different.
Unusual show for unusual times. Kimberly Adams stepping in literally at the last minute for Molly Wood, who we hope is safe and her neighbors are safe from that fire that's around the corner. We are back tomorrow. We've changed gears a little bit. We're going to do defund the police, and we're going to talk about that and what it means.
But wait, you said we were the hosts, so we can go long. I don't have a make me smile, but I would really love yours.
Well, so mine is, I mean, I was going to just go out on your thoughtfulness, but mine is it's actually related, because the Secretary of the Army came out today and said, you know, and this is stunning. It's a huge change, actually, for the United States Army. He is willing to have a conversation, a bipartisan conversation. His name is Ryan McCarthy, Secretary of the Army, about taking the names of Confederate generals off the 10 U.S. Army bases that are currently named for Confederate generals, like Fort Lee and Fort Bragg and some of those really historic, you know, 82nd Airborne kind of places, Ranger School places. Ranger School is at Fort Benning. But anyway, that were named after guys who tried to overthrow the American government. And I think that's fascinating. Also, let me give a shout out to CJ Chivers here, a reporter for the New York Times, former Marine, who wants to know from the United States Navy whether they are going to rename the USS John C. Stennis, the aircraft carrier, named after an avowed segregationist. And I just think it is a moment that we're having.
That makes me smile. Important.
Yeah.
Thank you.
There you go. There you go. Okay. So tomorrow, me and Molly, provided her home is intact. If not, Kimberly, I guess we'll call you again. We'll be talking about defund the police.
No, no, no. Apparently the fire is contained now.
Okay, good. All right, good, good. That's on the big show tomorrow. Otherwise, that's what we got.
Yeah. Yeah. So Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Digital producer is Tony Wagner, and the senior producer is Jody Becker. Ben Heathcote is our video producer, and Ethan Peretz is our video intern. And a special thanks to writer-producer Erica Phillips.
Daniel Ramirez was in charge today. Theme music was composed by Ben Talladay, and Daniel Ramirez, the executive director of On Demand, is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Once again, bow down to Kimberly Adams for stepping in and hooking us up today. Thanks.
Thanks, Kai. That was nice.
Yeah, you bet. Well, look, you rock. You're a star. You know that.
Aw.
Maybe you don't hear it.
Thanks. Oh, boy.
All right.
The world.
There we go. Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.